Welcome to the Zandbergen Report, where wealth strategies and investment wisdom collide, featuring your distinguished host and certified financial planner, Bart Zandbergen.
Welcome to the Zandbergen Report, a showcase for wealth strategies and investment wisdom that's essential for our evolving world. I'm your host, Bart Zandbergen. As usual, we have our producer in the studio today. Paul, how are you?
I am always excited at the people you bring in. You bring in such a wide scope of people. And today you're doing God's work today here. You're helping good people here to tell good stories.
So. That's right. And as I understand, it's kind of near and dear to your heart,
Paul. Very near and dear to my heart. You're talking about people who were in, kids are in, brought into foster care and what happens to them here.
So I'm so excited to have our guest here today. We have Reagan Phillips, CEO of CASA. Reagan, welcome.
Thank you, Bart. Hello.
Hello. We also have Matt Wadlinger. He was the Chief Communications Officer of CASA. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Of course. So, as most of our listeners know, that while most of our program is about financials and so forth, part of what we do is give back, and we're looking always for great causes, and you know, this has become something that's very, very near and dear to my heart. So I'm so glad to have you guys here today and learn more about CASA and more about what you do and how you're changing the world.
Well, thank you for having us.
Of course. So, Reagan, you have such a, you know, we had a chance to get to know each other a little bit the last couple of weeks, and you have such a great background. I don't think it does any justice to read your bio, but one thing that I'm really excited about is we're one of the few that are actually born and raised in Orange County.
True, yes.
I think we're a minority in the county.
We got both of them here today.
Right. and I know that you have extensive studies and that you're a lawyer, and then in part of your law studies were helping underprivileged kids and so forth.
Yes.
Do you mind? I mean, let's hear your story. How did you get to where you are today?
Absolutely. Well, I'm happy to share it. I have my story with CASA, I feel like, is actually kind of full circle. I was in graduate school in New York City following college and studying social work, and I had an internship with CASA, Court-Appointed Special Advocates in New York. And my year-long experience there really cemented my interest in children's rights advocacy and a feeling that perhaps if I got a law degree, I could make some real difference, and I could, you know, be a real change agent for kids. So I came back to Orange County, went to law school here locally at Chapman, and immediately upon graduation began, and passing the bar, began representing kids in the foster care system, the dependency system here in Orange County as a lawyer, and realized pretty quickly that lawyers are empowered to do a lot, but they're not able to do enough, as much as I certainly thought I would be able to do. I didn't meet every single one of my clients. There's a lot of overwhelm in the system, and the professionals, although well-intentioned, are overburdened. My familiarity with the organization, with CASA, allowed me to really rely on those advocates and volunteers in the courtroom to assist me with my process in representing the kids, and ultimately I went on to go and join the board for the organization here in Orange County. I supported through different fundraising events and committees, and about 4.5 years ago, or 4 years ago, I joined the staff on a program side. Great. As the chief program officer. It's one of those needs and organizations that I think once you know about, doesn't quite leave you, and truly the real difference is being made by the volunteers that are in the courtroom.
Yeah. That's so great. And you have three kids of your own, right?
I do.
And what's a Bernadoodle?
A Bernadoodle. yes, I have my husband to thank for this. It is a half Bernese Mountain Dog, half poodle. It vaguely resembles a Muppet, but it is
on the large side, like
it's a large
like
dog.
A Bernese, yeah.
They're big, and they're very shaggy, and but very, very cute. He gets a lot of attention everywhere we go. Yes.
That's awesome. Hey, Matt, how about a little bit about you and your background?
Yeah. So, not one of the Orange County natives. I'm from New England. I grew up in New Hampshire and Maine. Moved out here about 8.5 years ago. And CASA was the only job that I've had since I moved out here. And I've been in a lot of different roles now. Started out on the program side. Used to run a program called Family Connections, where we do family finding work for kids in the foster care system, try to find long-lost relatives, bring them into the fold, develop connections with the kids, hopefully start some relationships for them, especially for the kids that don't have anyone visiting them beyond their CASA volunteer. And then I've kind of moved over to the fundraising side, and now I oversee our fundraising events and marketing and PR stuff for CASA.
That's great. And I'm gonna have you talk all about this event that's coming up in just a little bit. So Reagan, let's kind of start with the basics for people who don't know. What does the acronym CASA stand for, and what's your mission statement?
Yeah, so CASA stands for Court-Appointed Special Advocates. Our mission statement is that CASA provides a powerful voice for youth in the child welfare system through a unique one-on-one relationship with trained and supervised court-appointed volunteer advocates. We work to ensure that the youth are safe, have a permanent home, and an opportunity to thrive. What I typically tell people is that we are an organization that's empowered by the juvenile court to create meaningful connections between really well-intentioned volunteers in our community and children in the foster care system. And again, these are children, when I'm referring to that population, that have been removed from their home because of abuse, neglect, or abandonment. And they range in age from 0 to 21. And in Orange County alone, there are over 3,100 children that fit that description.
Wow.
So the need is great.
Yeah. I can't believe there's that many in our county.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah.
So when did CASA establish itself in Orange County?
In Orange County, we will actually celebrate our 35th anniversary as an organization here in Orange County next year in 2020, something we're looking forward to. The organization is a national one, and it was established just over 40 years ago up in Seattle by a judge who was overseeing these types of cases and realized pretty quickly, you know, these are kids that even under the best case of circumstances, maybe they reunify with a family member or a parent, maybe they get adopted, the process can still take up to 2 years.
Wow.
That's a lot of time in a kid's life. And there were a lot of needs and issues that are happening on the daily basis that are not getting addressed by the well-intentioned professionals dealing with the legal matters at hand. So he believed that having a volunteer person, someone who was not paid to be there, but simply connect with the child and ask them questions and try to impress upon them that they are concerned for them and wanting to connect with them, that they would be able to ascertain information that would really truly help make a difference in these children's lives. And that's exactly what we see with our organization.
Wow. So the kids that we're speaking of, and especially have been abused or whatnot, they're typically not in the family home, right? They're now removed.
That's true. Okay. Many of them are currently in Orange County. There are, of that 3,100 number I gave you earlier, there's about there's over 2,300 children that are in out-of-home care. So some of the children may be at various stages of reunification. Perhaps they are living with their parents now that they've addressed a safety issue or whatever it might be that was that caused removal in the first place. But the bulk of them, the majority of them, are not in their home of origin and are, you know, trying to secure placement somewhere else. Permanency somewhere else.
So then how do they get into the foster care system? What does that process look like?
Well, you know, it looks like social services getting involved because there's been a telephone call or a report of some type of abuse, neglect, some sort of circumstances that don't read favorably for the child. Investigations are then conducted, and ultimately a decision is made by a judge, first by a social worker, but then ultimately solidified or verified by a judge to keep that child away from their parents. The detention hearing, it is a arguably the most important hearing that these children face. Once that happens, a litany of legal procedures and hearings begin to determine, you know, whether there's a reunification that should happen or not.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a complicated process.
Yeah.
It's very involved. And again, for the child at hand, the focus at the front stage is largely on the parents and disputing allegations and figuring out what, you know, whether these allegations and this action was correct. All the while, you've got a child that's, you know, perhaps not getting the focus that they deserve and need.
Do you have any idea what percentage of kids actually end up going back that are reunited with their parents?
Successfully reunify?
Yeah.
I don't know, Matthew, if we have a percentage exactly, but I know it's low, unfortunately. And I think that, you know, there are efforts that are made to reunify, certainly, but it's really about finding permanency with someone else at that point, if we're not able to. It's about getting them out of the system and finding a way for them to grow up in a family environment with loving, supportive family members who are going to ensure that they go to school and can then become, you know, independent, self-sufficient, contributing members of society.
Yeah.
When that doesn't happen, because CASA, we don't work with every child in the system. We get referred perhaps the most at-risk youth, the children that do not have probably a very strong likelihood of reunification, probably have the fewest contacts and supportive people in their lives outside of their attorney and social worker, and they really do have the need for someone to be paying attention at that level. So certainly for us, the percentage is low. Our volunteers are really in there trying to make sure that those needs are met so that we can prevent the abuse, the cycle of abuse and neglect for their children.
Mm-hmm. Just one quick question.
Yes,
I can't
please.
Not pipe
please,
up doing
Paul,
this.
You're an expert.
I adopted a child out of foster care. She was 10. And all these questions, I'm just chomping at the bit to jump in and give my 2 cents worth. You know, none of these kids go into the system willingly or easily. They're all seized and taken. In my own daughter's case, just to give you an example, she was raised in a small village in Mexico, abandoned by her mother. Grandmother dies, brought into the country illegally. Everybody's always saying, why don't you do something about those illegals? I adopted one of them. And then she was brought to a distant relative in East LA who beat the hell out of her. And so she went to school for the first time, and the school saw that she was all black and blue and seized her and called the cops, and she never went home, and that was it. Suddenly she's in a foreign country, you know, trying to adapt as she moved from home to home to home. One of the things that you're talking about is that I don't think people get, I didn't get, so many of these kids don't get adopted. Once they pass the little baby age, who wants a damaged child here? My wife and I looked at each other. Do we want, you know, a damaged, upset, angry child here? And yes, they can be fixed, and they can adapt. They're pretty pliable, but so many of them don't get adopted. And talk about what happens when they age out of the system, and how many of them do. We took them into the system to save them. We can't save them, and so we basically just discharge them and give them a couple $100 and say good luck.
Right. Yeah. No, it's a system that is broken. It's not really working. There may be, you know, good intentions behind trying to help these children, but we haven't been able to figure out a way to make it better for them. They've all experienced profound trauma. The removal, regardless of the circumstances surrounding removal, I've never represented a child or worked with a child that didn't want to go back home to their parents, regardless of how bad the circumstances were.
Wow.
So that in and of itself is trauma, because that's what they know. That's their experience.
Right.
And then, again, it's this moving through the system, myriad placements, myriad school changes. You know, we have kids that have been in, you know, 40 homes, have changed schools, you know, many times. There's not that consistency. That's what kids need. That's what that allows kids to thrive. Mm-hmm. And that's what our organization seeks to provide for them by way of the best thing we can conceive of with the system, absent of a family, a volunteer.
I'll only say one more thing here. The dramatic picture that struck us is when our daughter she was brought in the system when she's about 8. In a couple of years, she'd gone through 4 or 5 different foster homes up in East LA and different schools and whatnot. We found her, we took her in, and through foster adopt, we actually were foster parents, and then we adopted her after a year or two, because it takes a couple of years to go through the process. And when she came to us, we went to pick her up. She didn't have a suitcase or a backpack, so they put all her stuff in a garbage bag. And I said, what? And they said, oh, this is all the social work. So this is all the kids, because they're just taken. They don't go home and pack and take all their stuff. They're taken physically, like, so the cop comes and gets them and takes them out of the home, and they leave with nothing, and they move through the system with nothing. And so what does that say to a kid when they go to your house and everything they have in the world is in a garbage bag? You know, that was a dramatic image.
That is
here.
Dramatic.
It is.
So I want to make sure that we're clear. So CASA is not a foster care system, correct?
Correct.
Yeah.
We're a service, we're a support service to the system,
okay,
to the court, to the professionals in the court system. I would call it a quasi-governmental support or service. But also, you know, we're these volunteers are occupying a role of a mentor, and you know, a listening ear, someone who is going to just be there for that child and let them know that they're cared for and that they're cared about, and you know, speak up for them, whether that be to the social worker, whether that be to their teacher. We're empowered to talk to any of the people affiliated with their case. Our volunteers go through an extensive training, 30 hours. We don't require that they have any kind of experience or expertise with the system, with the law, with social services. We'll provide that training. We want to make sure they're going to clear a background check and that they're safe people to connect with this very vulnerable population. Once they've gone through the training and they've been vetted and welcomed by our agency, they become sworn in as officers of the court. And that is what enables them to be a participant in these proceedings, because they are otherwise very confidential. And perhaps part of the reason why so little is known about this population is because of the confidentiality surrounding their circumstances and the fact that the general public can't really know about what's going on.
So how does a child get referred to CASA?
We get referrals for kids that are in the system through the judge, through an attorney, a social worker, and sometimes we get referrals because the kids are requesting our services. If a youth is living in a group home, for instance, and they see another youth in the group home going out and having an outing and doing something fun with their CASA, they say, what was that about? I want to go do that. I want to go have a go to the beach. We just got a picture today of a youth, the advocate for Christmas, was able to secure some gloves and a jacket for this child, and the advocate over the weekend took him up to the mountains, and he experienced snow for the first time, and they got to do that together. So they do things that are, you know, fun and enjoyable, and they get to experience things with their CASA that they wouldn't otherwise have had.
So just randomly, Tyler, who we
know. Yeah, of course.
Right, so I have an older daughter, and she was with her kids at the
Monster Jam.
Monster Jam. And she had met Tyler a week before, and she said she looked over, she goes, Tyler was there with a kid. And I started thinking, like, Tyler doesn't have any kids. He brought one of his kids, right?
Both Tyler and his wife, Rachel, are advocates with our organization. They each work with a different child.
That's so cool.
Really powerful.
I'm already starting to figure this out, but just so we're clear with the listener, so what are some of the benefits and outcomes of a child in the foster care system when they have a CASA?
Oh, there's so many, and it really varies depending on the child and the age, but I mean, it can be anything from you're seeing the high school graduation rates for the general foster care population. The high school graduation rates here in California are 48%. If they have a CASA volunteer in Orange County, we've seen that rate jump to 93.
That's
a huge benefit right there. Then you have the likelihood of them establishing other relationships, having opportunities. The fact that there are kids that are, you know, smiling. Sometimes it's a matter of them going to school every day of the week and being able to feel like they have a trusted support system. But we've seen kids graduate, we've seen them go on to college, we've seen them go on to obtain other types of degrees and credentials and get jobs out in the community and really turn a life around that might not otherwise have looked like much. One of my favorite stories is about this youth that was matched with one of our advocates, Janice, who was honored a few years ago at one of our events and our gala that we have. This was a child who was 12 years old. He was deaf and was diagnosed with a condition, echolalia, where he would basically repeat whatever was told to him. He wouldn't communicate on his own. He was a violent child, which was prone to hitting and behaviors. So when he was finally matched with Janice, who was able to sign with him, she was told, you can't go off-site with this child. He has to stay in the back because he has these violent tendencies. Through her interactions with him and her consistent showing up and being supportive and trying to communicate with him, she learned that he was able to communicate independently. He was instigating conversations, initiating words with her, learning. She's taught him a whole vocabulary, how to sign, advocated for him in the classroom to get him a sign language teacher that can so he can understand what's going on. His behaviors have de-escalated. He participates on a special Olympics basketball and soccer team. He has this child has a life that he would not have otherwise had because someone had, basically decided, oh, this kid doesn't talk, and he's going to stay in the back room. Let's just not bother this child.
I'm going to pipe up one more time here. Yes. So many of these kids are lost, Bart. They get into the system with good intention, and then they move from home to home, and these agencies are underfunded and overstretched. The people come and go. The social workers don't get paid much. And in our own daughter's case, when we finally identified her, and they presented us this portfolio and said, do you want to look at this girl? My first question is, does she speak English? And they didn't know. They'd had her in the system for 2 years, and the people who had last seen her had left, and so nobody actually knew. LA County's caring for this child and didn't know if she could speak English or not. She's lost. They all get lost in the system, particularly as they age and move from home to home and round about here. So I think a CASA advocate would be huge. I didn't know there was such a thing. She didn't have one. To have somebody who just cares about these kids and pays attention to them.
That's exactly what it is.
That's amazing. Yeah. So how many kids does your agency serve in a year, and is there a wait list for kids?
Yes. So this year we are poised to serve over 800 kids, over 800 of the youth in the system. We do have a wait list at all times. Currently it's at about 250. It's been hovering there for some time now.
Wow. So how many volunteers do you have currently?
We have
500.
Yeah,
500 active.
Are you actively looking for more volunteers to take care of that wait list, or are you at, is that a capacity?
Well, yeah, I'm going to refer this one to Matthew because he oversees our recruitment.
We're absolutely looking for more volunteers right now. And what Reagan always tells people is, you know, we're just looking for people that have an open heart and open mind. We provide all the training, the resources, the support once you come to our program and you get matched up with the youth. So it's twice a month visits with the kid is the minimum expectation level there for a couple hours. You pick the kid up at their group home, their foster home, take them out on an outing. Monster Jam might be an outing. Just really get to know the kid, see where they're at in life, and then through the collection of all that information while you're matched up with the kid, that's how you're going to be able to advocate for them. And then, so that's the unique thing about our organization is our volunteers will attend periodic review hearings at the dependency courthouse in Orange every 6 months and literally stand up in front of the judge and they'll advocate for the child that they're working with. And sometimes that's in the realm of educational needs, whether or not they're in a good placement in that study there, and then life skills. So once a kid's over 15, 16, really preparing them for when they leave the foster care system so that they're able to live on their own and thrive.
Wow. Okay. So we went over a lot of this, but just to be clear, what does someone do to become a volunteer?
Yeah, they would go to our website first things first and sign up for an informational session.
Yeah, so casoc.org is our website. We have at least two or three information sessions every month, so you attend one of those and then you can sign up for training. Training's offered every other month. It's 30 hours. Some people have to take it over a couple different training sessions and we work with you on that. And then there's background checks and reference checks that we do to vet out all of our volunteers. But once you do all that stuff, you get sworn in by the judge and then we'll match you up with one of the kids that we have on the wait list right now.
So great. So let's take a kind of slightly different direction. What happens when a CASA disagrees with recommendations from a social worker or from the child's attorney or from a court meeting?
It happens. As some of the judges will tell me or tell anyone, no CASA has ever made their job easier. We put them in that role in order to identify some of the lapses in services and issues that are maybe not going the way that they should. So they do, they are empowered to advocate for that and point those out. We have really, thankfully, very good relationships with court, with the bench, with social services. We have regular standing meetings outside of our respective roles to make sure that we're addressing any issues that may come up between our respective organizations. But generally speaking, I think that there's a lot of value that's ascribed to these recommendations coming from our volunteers because they do have that very, very special, unique one-on-one relationship. And so I think that I am unaware of any significant disagreements that have occurred. I am aware, however, of the fact that sometimes our recommendations, though contrary to what might be happening, have really changed the outcomes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So we love stories here on the show, especially success stories. So you must have hundreds of them. Can you share one or two?
Oh, yes. Actually, Matthew has a really good one that I would like for him to share.
Okay.
It's okay.
Sure. So I was speaking about being in charge of the Family Finding Program. And so the very first case that I worked in that program was for a 16-year-old girl. Her name was, we'll call her Holly. And Holly was matched up with her CASA volunteer, and her CASA's name was Linda. And they were matched for about 6 months. And on their outings together, Linda realized that Holly never spoke about her father. She never spoke about any paternal family. And so she thought, okay, well, you know, I'll ask Holly about this. And so Holly said, well, I know my dad's first name. His first name's Mike. And my mom told me that he's a bad and mean man. So that's all that she knew about her dad. That's all that she knew about her whole paternal family. And so she made the referral to our program. And then myself and CASA Linda went over to social services together, met the social worker. She gave us all of the volumes of paperwork since Holly came into care and sat us down in an empty cube. And so we started to go through everything and we found out that Holly entered foster care when she was 6 years old, and so she's 16 now. And over that 10-year period, she had six different social workers, six different placements, which isn't uncommon for any of the kids that we're working with. And then also in Volume 1, we found her birth certificate, which had her dad's full name, his date of birth. So we jotted that down. We hung out there for another hour or two, went through more paperwork, and then Casa Linda went home, and I went back to the office to start the search into dad. And he had kind of a unique last name as well, so I typed it into Facebook. You know, it's free, easy. Most people are on it. One person popped up. It was an African-American male, which was what we were looking for. He also had this gap in between his two front teeth, which this child had as well, so there was some similarities, like, right away. And he also had an open profile, so if you're familiar with Facebook, you know, you can kind of just, like, stalk the person at that point. And so that's what I did. I went through his photo albums. He was remarried. He had two young kids. He was living in Oklahoma for his job. It said that he was an associate pastor at his church. So everything looked good on the surface, and it had his town name listed in his Facebook profile as well. So typed in his name and the town name into whitepages.com, got the phone number, gave dad a phone call, all literally in the same day.
Wow.
And he picked up the phone, and no one ever picks up the phone, you know, if you don't know who's calling, you don't pick it up. He picked it up, and I identified who I was and why I was calling him, and he immediately broke down in tears, and he told me that when Holly first entered care when she was 6 years old, the intake social worker reached out to him and said, you know, your daughter's coming into the foster care system. She was six at the time, but they had a prospective adoptive family. But before they could move forward with the family, they needed dad to terminate his rights. And he wasn't in a good place personally and professionally, and he knew that he couldn't care for the child. So he terminated his rights. He got the paperwork mailed to him, terminated his rights. And then the adoption fell through. The social workers changed, and no one gave dad a phone call back. So over that 10-year period, he thought his daughter was growing up in a loving, supportive, adoptive home. His daughter was growing up in the foster care system. Again, six placements, six different social workers. So we ran background checks on dad. Everything checked out, did reference checks, and then we were able to, with funding that we have for this program, we were able to fly dad and his new wife out to Orange County. She was in her junior year of high school, started visits right away. And then by the time she graduated from high school the following year, we flew him out to Orange County again. And then I was sitting there next to his dad at the graduation. And immediately following that, we had a nice lunch. And then I dropped them off at John Wayne Airport. And this kid left the foster care system and moved in with her dad.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So that was kind of, you know, that was the first case that I ever worked at CASA. And I was instantly hooked at that point. I mean, the way that we're able to transform these lives is tremendous.
Wow, that is amazing. Whew, that's a good one. All right, I'm going to wrap this two questions into one. And the question is, you know, how do you financially sustain yourself in the community? And I think that's wrapped up into one of the things that you have coming up. So can you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. So we're about like 95% privately funded right now. And so we actually have a big gala coming up on April 27th at Hotel Irvine. And there are sponsorships and tickets available, CASAcelebrationofchildren.org. So you can go to the website and check it out. We are looking for more sponsors for the event. Bart, you're part of the committee for that as well, helping us out. So there'll be silent auction, live auction, a really nice dinner. We got some entertainment planned as well as some other surprises coming along. So it's a really big and fun event that we have every year. For the last 4 years, it's netted our organization over $1 million, and we run on a budget of a little over $3 million. So it's a huge revenue source for us. So we're really excited about that.
That's so great. Yeah. That's so great. Any final comments before we close up, Reagan?
No, I think we're very grateful for the opportunity to be able to raise awareness for the organization and to share about our mission and what we're doing for kids here, and also just to let people know about the need that these kids have. Once kids are removed from their homes, they're really all of our children. We're all paying for them. We should be, you know, concerned about what's going to happen to them when this is over. And this program, from my perspective, really is a proactive way to try to eliminate the cycle of abuse and neglect and give kids a chance to live a healthy and successful life.
So great.
Despite their circumstances.
Yeah. All right, so before we close up, and we're running really low on time, but I always have the honor of asking my guests their final thought question. So the final thought question for you, Reagan, is what is your ultimate lesson learned over your career in, your entire career has been working with kids.
Well, I think, you know, specifically as it relates to my involvement with CASA, is, and in this role, I get to see so much good, you know, whether it be from our volunteers and what they do stepping up for these kids, the donors and supporters who come to the table to want to help us achieve our mission in other ways, our staff, that's incredible, and their level of commitment to what they're doing. I think that I've learned that people are just really and truly inherently good. There is so much good out there, yeah, notwithstanding what we're hearing, yeah, these days in particular. Yeah. There's a lot of really good people out there, and we're capable of doing good together.
That's always great to end on a high note. That's a good one.
Yeah.
Do either of you want to let us know how the best way to reach either of you?
Yeah, casoc.org, or you could call 714-619-5151.
Great. All right, I want to thank you both for being in studio today. It's been such a great pleasure. I want to thank everyone who's been listening. We look forward to seeing you back in studio, or here, being back in studio next week, and we'll have you tune in. So we look forward to being back next week. Cheers.
Tune in next week for the latest edition of the Zandbergen Report, Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Catch up on our recent shows by visiting bartzandbergen.podbean.com. The Zandbergen Report is also available on iTunes, iHeartRadio, and Spotify. Interested in being a featured guest on our show, or have a question you'd like to hear us answer? Email podcast@bartzandbergen.com. Bart A. Zandbergen, CFP, and Letitia Burbaum, AIF, are registered investment advisors with Optivest Inc. and registered representatives with Gramercy Securities Inc., member FINRA and SIPC. Investment advisory services are offered by Optivest Inc. under SEC registration.